It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
In 1931, Matthew Williams was lynched in Salisbury, Maryland. But despite the long years, have we really come to grips with his legacy? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There is no plaque where Matthew Williams was lynched in Salisbury, and a controversy continues to swirl around the historical marker that notes a Confederate general who oversaw Union prisoners during the Civil War. It is a complex legacy that still haunts the community on its outer edges, just out of sight. Next month, the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project and the Lily Carroll Jackson Civil Rights Museum will hold a conference in Baltimore. It will take place at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. It is entitled Lynching in Maryland, Journey from Truth to Reconciliation. In our studio this morning is James Yamakawa, who has been involved in the vigils for Matthew Williams and has volunteered his time for the project. And also on the phone is Dr. Nicholas Creary. He's an assistant professor at Bowie State University. And welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with you, James, and because I start with this idea that we have this particular issue of Matthew Williams. Describe for us a little bit about, obviously, what happened to him and what you think the significance is in terms of this community.
Well, Matthew Williams was a young black man in Salisbury in 1933. He was 23 years old. He worked for a local lumberyard owner named Daniel Elliott, and stories differ depending on who you talk to. The official story is that there was a wage dispute and that Matthew Williams shot his employer, Daniel Elliott. Other stories included the fact that, like, you know, it was actually Daniel Elliott's son who borrowed money from Matthew Williams, and Matthew Williams went to his employer, who was a friend of the family, to get this matter settled, and that the son actually shot both of them. What is known for sure is that Matthew Williams was injured in whatever happened, taken to Peninsula General Hospital, which is now PRMC. He was abducted by a mob of maybe about 100 men out of the hospital, taken to the courthouse lawn, where upwards of 1,000 residents took part in hanging him from a tree just outside the courthouse. And his body was then dragged through the black neighborhoods of Salisbury and then set on fire. And yeah, that's pretty much what happened.
And of course, one thing irony is, of course, is that the black community, which was just right nearby, mm-hmm. could actually look down and see this.
Yes. And the choice of taking his body, I mean, the dragging it on a truck through the neighborhoods was intentional. There were black wait staff at the Wamacomico Hotel that were forced to watch the lynching. And the point was, it's an act, it's a public spectacle, but it's also an act of racial control, basically saying to the black residents, you know, we technically don't own you, but we're going to do what we want to with you.
Now, you've been obviously involved with an archaeological project, and you've discovered another person who appears to have been killed during the same time.
That was actually jointly between local historian Linda Dwyer and the folks at the Equal Justice Initiative. There was a man, I don't know the age, and we don't know the name, obviously, just in the days after Matthew Williams. There was kind of an informal curfew of the black community. They're saying, like, just don't go out at night at all. And this man needed groceries. They found his body up by the railroad tracks in Salisbury, basically, like, you know, his head beaten in. They knew he was going to get groceries because they found, like, a brown paper bag with, like, half a ham in it. Mm. Like, you know, he had gone out to get food. I mean, because no one can go out. And people obviously still wanted blood, so a group found him and beat his brains in. And the Equal Justice Initiative down in Montgomery, Alabama, actually has unknown on one of the steel memorial columns in the National Memorial now. And so officially, there are 3 recorded lynchings in Salisbury. There may be more, obviously, that we don't know about.
I want to turn to you, Dr. Creary. And move back in time a bit to the beginning of lynchings, in terms of their proliferation, which I understand really take place after the Tilden Rutherford B. Hayes agreement, the end of construction. Tell me a little bit about that beginning.
Well, sure. I mean, we do have documented cases of lynching going back to as early as 1854. Again, on the Eastern Shore, that would have been, you know, David Thomas, who was lynched in Denton in Caroline County. But again, I mean, there were a few there, but several, you know, most of the cases of lynching, as you said, do begin to really pick up in terms of larger numbers, you know, after Reconstruction. There are several during the Reconstruction period on both sides of the bay. But the larger number of them do really begin to, you know, to take up after 1877. And as James was saying, I mean, these are basically terror lynchings. You know, lynchings that were meant to keep blacks in their place. As he said, I mean, sort of the idea was that they may not own blacks anymore, but, you know, they specifically wanted to keep them in their place of subservience. I was just going back over the information about Garfield King, the first lynching that happened in Wicomico County. And in the wake of that lynching, because he was alleged to have murdered a white person, you know, somebody from the community, I believe it was Allen, you know, wrote a letter which in part said, let's be clear, this is a white man's county, and you know, Negroes just, you know, do not, you know, have any hope of leadership or, you know, of being able to rise and do anything, you know, for themselves. So, I mean, this is very much part of, you know, not just the Eastern Shore, but, you know, it was very much a, you know, across the state of Maryland. And again, it sort of cinches for me, you know, the argument that Maryland was and still is in many ways a southern state, even though it didn't secede from the Union during the war. It acted in very, very southern ways, particularly in the way it went about lynching and using violence as a means to maintain control over the African American communities.
One of the quotes I ran across in observation of this was that the lynching basically was an act that was turned into a symbolic rite in which the black victim became really a representative of his race. And that's a warning as to the black population not to challenge white supremacy. Indeed, what is suggested here is that it wasn't even so much the individual crime or alleged crime or incident or whatever it is that they justified by it, but rather it became much greater than that for the white community.
Yeah, very much so. This was all about white supremacy and, you know, again, trying to maintain black people in, you know, so-called, you know, quote, in their place. You know, if an African-American person, you know, was too successful as a business person, was starting to make more money than whites, that was seen as a threat. In many cases, you know, again, I think of, you know, one of the cases that happened in Prince George's County where somebody was lynched for allegedly arson, you know, sort of allegedly burning the tobacco, you know, barns of several people in Prince George's County. You know, there's a real possibility that these people were, you know, the Vermilion family was being rather successful and was doing at least as well, if not better, than some of the local farmers. And so, yes, they lynched, you know, Joe Vermilion, perhaps because they were being, you know, too economically successful. You know, not all of the lynchings had to do with attempted, you know, assault or, you know, some sort of sexual relationship with white women. You know, in fact, in most cases outside of Maryland, you know, more often than not, you know, lynchings usually happened because black people were either economically successful or, you know, said the wrong thing or got into it with white folks for some reason. And it didn't take much of a reason to get a lynch mob up and active, you know, back in the day.
The other thing that strikes me is that this seemed to unite all strata in terms of economics, whether you were poor, white, whether you were middle class, and so on.
Yes, very much so. I mean, and that's where, you know, as I said, it, you know, the ultimate end of the day, I mean, it was, you know, to support and maintain the ideology of white supremacy. You know, even, you know, to the perfunctory, you know, sort of after the lynching, almost inevitably you had in the papers, you know, people saying, oh, well, this is a terrible thing. This was a travesty of justice. They should have let, you know, the legal system run its course. But there was no real attempt at remorse or saying, you know, we could have prevented this. And so it's usually, oh, darn, the sheriff could have done a better job. Or, but they ultimately, you know, exonerate him because, well, it was a big mob. He was overpowered. So, yes, I mean, and that's the key thing about lynching is, I mean, it's a community that's involved in that, that was involved in it. It wasn't just, you know, that's what makes it different from just straight up murder. I mean, this was community. This was coordinated, planned, you know, the silence, you know, the code of silence associated with it, you know, along with the concomitant silencing of the victim community. That's what makes this such a truly heinous crime.
James, picking up on that, there is this idea that, it is an epidemic of silence, that it infected residents and no one wanted to speak out for fear of implicating their neighbors, much less, I suppose, betraying their neighbors. I mean, there seems to be that. Not only is there obviously the emphasis on trying to control the black population, but it also controls the white population as well.
Well, when you if you take the estimate of about 1,000 people for Matthew Williams lynching, that's like 10% of the town. I mean, that's a significant, you know, number of people. Chances are, you know, if you were not in that crowd, you knew someone or were very closely related to someone who was in that crowd. No one wants to, like, you know, assignate blame to their neighbor for what they're doing. I guess that's a human impulse. But the silence afterwards, it meant just as much to control the white population as well, saying like that there's no way you can ever, find atonement for this act because you're not allowed to talk about it. And they talk about psychological damage. I mean, obviously the damage and the violence against the African American community is obviously the prime point of this. No one's debating that,
right.
But there is a simultaneous damage to the white community as well, psychologically and culturally. When you are, even if you're not part of this mob, and actually in a lot of the larger lynch mobs in the South, children and families were obviously, they were involved. They were required to take part. I don't know if there were children in this mob, but if there were, they were tangentially related. You're basically taught that these people's lives don't matter, that you are required to, you know, keep that silence. And how does that psychologically affect you in the future? You're going to grow up knowing that, you know, that this violence is acceptable and that it kind of dehumanizes them permanently in your mind. There's psychological studies that say kind of show that it does have an effect on the white community as well. And I probably still dealing with that nationally, the results of that in our culture.
Just to follow up quickly on that, I do believe that it was in the Matthew Williams case that a high school football team, and I don't remember exactly from where, but there was a high school football team, you know, staying in the hotel across the street from where his body was burned, and they were apparently there and watching. So yes,
right.
Children there.
I think it was Wicomico High School or Salisbury High School, and the team from Del Mar. They were having dinner at the restaurant or hotel, and so
right.
Yeah. So we're at least teenagers. Thank you. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah, and then the other thing, you know, in terms of the damage, I mean, the significance of the, and again, it goes back to the conspiracy, you know, within the community, because in every case, you know, in Maryland that I've seen, After the body's taken down, and you know that they convene a jury of inquest, you know, and inevitably the ruling is the same. You know, this person met his death at the hands of parties unknown. Now, never mind the fact that particularly in the Garfield King case, the Baltimore Sun is very clear in stating that the members of the lynch mob did not have masks on their face. They made no attempt or effort to hide their identities in any way. And yet everybody, you know, who testified before the jury of inquest said, nope, we didn't see anybody. We couldn't see. It wasn't possible to make out, you know, their faces because it was so darkly lit. That's conspiracy. I mean, that, you know, I mean, we can talk about the psychological damage and, you know, the damage to the white community, but that, you know, shows the complicity of the legal system, you know, in covering for the people who engaged in this crime.
Well, one of the things I was struck by as I've been looking around are photographs in which not only obviously you have the person who's been lynched, but then you have this large number of people who are out looking at the camera as if, I don't know whether they're proud or what do you make of those images? That there's not, they didn't hide behind hoods, that they were actually preserved mm-hmm. for all time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to, you know, again, the level of racism and the degree to which that violence against black people was normalized. I mean, this was seen as an entirely acceptable form of behavior. You know, the protests, you know, to the contrary, notwithstanding, I think they took great pride in that, and they weren't trying to hide from it, which, again, I think says a lot more about where, you know, sort of the American mindset and, you know, the American psyche was vis-a-vis race relations. And, yes, we can say we've come a long way, you know, happily, you know, we're not seeing these kinds of, you know, forms of violence happening anymore, but, you know, I still wonder, you know, again, you look at Charlottesville, you look at, you know, sort of those explicit, you know, statements of racist ideology. I mean, that's not too far removed from, you know, the people who were, as you said, sort of facing the camera with pride, you know, and look at what we've done here.
James, I want to, here in Salisbury, this lynching, and I'm sure probably in other communities as well, seems to be an intimate affair in the sense that you have both communities who are living basically side by side. Matter of fact, the African-American community actually extended for much further towards downtown, which, of course, now have been wiped out by the major highways. And after it all, the dust settles, the bodies removed, black people and white people then have to go back to interacting with one another, whether it's maids, whether it's somebody who at a store. I mean, what about that intimacy that you see in a small town, particularly like this?
Well, I mean, lynching is a brutal act, but it's also is, I mean, like any violence, it is intimate is the only word I could think. You're right, intimate, because it, like, you know, it's person on person. I mean, people were standing like a foot from Matthew Williams and Garfield King and this unknown man that was lynched right after that. I mean, you can't beat someone's head in without being right there. I mean, so, but going back to the people working together, obviously some of those people that the maids would go into the houses, like, you know, they may have been part of the mob, they may not have been. But the idea is that they're still complicit in it. Like, you know, I can only imagine that, like, you know, everyone knew exactly who was doing this. And I can't, I honestly, it's impossible, I mean, not impossible, but it's incredible to think that, you know, you can go in and back it to work with like that. But I guess if you had to, you had to. So, but the going back to the idea of complicity, it's as much the people kind of low-key keeping that silence and low-key, like, you know, so yeah, these are obvious acts of violent racism, but they're held up by the smaller acts of silence. Again, I don't even really think the silence in this case was really small. It's big. It was a community-wide conspiracy, essentially, but it's held up by small acts each day.
Yeah, and again, I would think that for people who, you know, in effect, from the black community who survived the lynching, as it were, to know, you know, if you were a maid going into somebody's house and you knew that your employer was part of the mob or was, you know, a bystander in the mob and did nothing or cheered it on, I mean, psychologically, that, I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what that must do to a person psychologically. But, I mean, to instill that fear, you know, and I think that's one of those key elements, to instill the fear so that, you know, you can't even begin to think about wanting to do something for yourself or to stand up for yourself in a significant way. That I think is the really chilling part, you know. And again, if we're talking about this in terms of, you know, the intimacy within a community, you know, and yet, you know, in the midst of all of that, to have, you know, because again, the other thing that happens frequently and certainly happened in the wake of the Garfield King lynching in 1898, the black communities would come together and have, I mean, indignation meetings, you know. And again, the fact that they developed a term, you know, that they were speaking out against, saying this is wrong, this is an injustice against us as a community, and they're calling on, you know, state government officials to investigate and to provide some sort of redress, you know, again, speaks, I would say, the heroism of these black communities, that in the midst of all of that and in that context, that they got together, you know, in their churches and they, you know, made speeches and made these petitions, and all of this was carried in the local and the, you know, papers and the Baltimore Sun. You know, so again, white folks had to have known that black folk were doing this. You know, that's nothing short of heroic in my book.
Let me ask you then, Professor, we get a decline somewhere around in the 1920s, beginning decline of this particular form of violence, that is lynching. Why does it decline? Because by the time we hit to the 1930s, you can see that it is dissipating. What brought that about?
Well, first of all, I mean, the Equal Justice Initiative, you know, in their report says that you can trace that, you know, there's a direct correlation between a decline in lynchings and a significant increase in executions. And so there's really not as great a need for lynching because the machinery of the state, you know, gets involved and begins to try and execute people in relatively quick fashion. So lynching and maybe that was the state's response to, you know, as their way to try to deal with, you know, the problem of lynching. And so, yeah, I mean, this is where, again, sort of this notion of black criminality and, you know, the association of blacks with crime, you know, really comes to a fore during this period. Now, the other thing, in particular to Maryland, is that, yes, between 1911 and 1931, there are no documented cases of lynching. That doesn't mean that there weren't cases of lynching that happened in that 20-year span. We just don't have any record of it. I mean, I would be willing to wager, you know, if somebody went out there and started doing some oral history, you could probably find some instances of lynchings that happened somewhere in the state of Maryland between 1911 and 1931. You know, I'd be willing to bet my next paycheck that you could find that. But again, that research hasn't been done, but I'd be willing to say. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's the state stepping in and executing people, you know, for these alleged crimes for which others would have been lynched is why you have the significant decrease in lynching happening during the first part of the 20th century.
Well, in some of my research, there seems to be some kind of shift that goes on in terms of public opinion It indicated, for instance, the Dyer anti-lynching bill, which passed the House, but was obviously killed in the Senate with a filibuster, came to the fore. Long discussion about the importance. We had some, I guess, the Southern White organizations, some of them condemned it. I think the Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching. There seems to be some, around this period of time, there does seem to be a shift in public sentiment.
Well, yes, because at this point, you know, the lynching and, you know, sort of the South is becoming an embarrassment to the nation, you know. I mean, here we see, and again, I mean, this gets picked up, you know, certainly, you know, especially during the Cold War. But, you know, it becomes very difficult for the United States to say, yes, we're the great democracy, you know, we're the land of the free and the home of the brave. And then, you know, the Soviet Union and communists and other, you know, organizations say, yeah, but look at how you treat your black people in the South. And so, yes, there is, you know, an attempt to try to curb that. I mean, as I said, because, I mean, it's becoming an embarrassment. And so, yes, there was. I mean, we did have the Dyer anti-lynching bill. There was even an attempt, I think it was in 1898, 1899, one of the delegates in the Maryland House of Delegates from Bel Air introduced, you know, an anti-lynching bill. It didn't get out of committee, but, you know, even in Maryland, there was an attempt. You know, so I think, yeah, there was, you know, a move away from this. And I think the involvement of the state, you know, moving towards, you know, swift trials and swift executions may well have been, you know, a part of that, you know, sort of broader move to try to stem some of the embarrassment that the South was causing, the, you know, the nation as a whole.
James, you've obviously been involved with trying to take the community's attention towards at least Matthew Williams and the lynching. We obviously had also the controversy over the Confederate general who, as I mentioned a moment ago, oversaw the Union prisons. And there's a plaque there. There's a protest against taking that plaque down. No move yet to put any plaque there for Matthew Williams. What do you make of how this community in the present day comes to grips with this? And the fact that we mentioned before they began the show that we're not more than a generation or two away from the people who were involved. And so that we know that there are people in this community whose relatives probably were there, if not involved directly.
One of the arguments that people made against the removal of the Winder marker from the courthouse lawn was that it was an act of erasing history. That argument can be made a thousand times and still be incorrect. It was not, it's not history. It's an inaccurate history at best. One of the arguments that I would make for having the community memorialize Matthew Williams, Garfield King, and this unknown man would be that this is history that actually belongs there. And this history actually belongs to our community. It is not, like, you know, pleasant history, obviously, but it's vital because it has shaped our community in itself. The people don't want to talk. Like, does anyone really want to talk about things that are uncomfortable, that may shine a bad light on us and our community? I can understand people wouldn't want to do that, but it doesn't mean it shouldn't happen. It means it's more important that it does. So I'm really not sure what else to say about that.
Well, let me tell you, go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, the other thing, yes, we know, what is it, something like 60,000 Marylanders ended up joining the Confederate Army, but, you know, constitutionally, the only crime that's defined in the U.S. Constitution is treason, you know, and so if we're putting up a plaque to memorialize and to remember these people who joined the Confederate Army, we're celebrating traitors. We're honoring, we're remembering people who engaged in acts of treason against the United States, particularly for Marylanders, because Maryland never seceded from the Union. Now, yes,
And
put them under martial law, but I mean, at the end of the day, we are, you know, memorializing treason and slavery. You know, that to me is unconscionable.
And not to mention the fact that the Winder marker being on the courthouse lawn where two of these men were lynched is sort of another another way of driving the knife further into the black community, saying, yes, you don't matter because we're going to have this here.
Dr. Kern, let me ask you one final question. It's a question that's come to my mind since I've been here, and that is whether or not the nation, obviously as a whole, but the South in particular, has ever come to grips with the legacy of slavery, that we never had that moment. The Germans, obviously, after the Second World War, had their moment. We don't seem to have had that moment yet, or maybe we're going through that now. I don't know.
No, we haven't had that moment yet. And I would take it one step further and, you know, let's not absolve the North, because there were plenty of lynchings that happened in border states that were technically northern states, too. No, I would say, going back to the beginning, race is the fundamental original sin of this nation, and we have not, you know, dealt with it or addressed it in any meaningful way, particularly since the Civil War. You know, like Sherry Lynn Ifill, I would argue we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or a Truth and Reconciliation process, because, you know, there cannot be reconciliation until we have the truth. And that means we have to recognize and acknowledge, as James was saying, that unpleasant truth, that lynching was a significant part of our history, North and South, and that nothing was done to try to address that or redress that. You know, again, speaks to, you know, volumes to how little we've done and how much farther we still have to go.
We've been speaking with James Yamakawa, who has been involved in the vigils for Matthew Williams, also involved with the project, the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project, that will be holding a new conference in Baltimore next month. And also on the phone with us is Dr. Nicholas Creary. He's assistant professor at Bowie State University. Appreciate you both of you joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Tangier is facing an uncertain future as it loses its landmass to erosion and the rising sea level. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In the summer of 1608, Captain John Smith started out his exploration of the Chesapeake Bay and ran across Tangier Island. It was much bigger then. It's now down to about 789 acres, and within 50 years, the U.S. government predicts another third will be gone. It is an island with a rich history and an enduring people. And it has been captured in a new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. And we have the author, Earl Swift, on the line with us this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. Happy to be here.
So, well, first of all, how did you get attracted or interested in this island?
Well, I spent 21 years as a reporter for the Virginian Pilot, the newspaper in Norfolk, and was sent to the island on a couple of assignments back in 1999, one of them being the millennium. I spent Y2K on Tangier. And insofar as it's a dry island and near a theocracy of old school Methodists, it was one of the quietest millennial celebrations on the planet, I'm betting. And during that visit, I spoke to a lot of islanders, and they told me that the waters that for centuries had sustained Tangier with its fish, crabs, and oysters was now poised to erase it. And I went back in 2000, spent 6 weeks on and off with a photographer on the island, and put together a newspaper, a package of newspaper stories about Tangier's existential plight at that point. And then I left for 15 years. And during that time, lived near the water in Norfolk and watched the water climb higher up into my yard and higher in my basement with each storm that came along, each astronomical high tide, and got to thinking that if the situation were this bad on the mainland, it had to be getting pretty dire out in Tangier. And so in the fall of 2015, resolved to go back and get a closer look.
Describe for me physically what the island looks like in terms of its major features.
Well, it's about 3 miles long and a mile wide. It's essentially a whisper of salt marsh surrounded by a lot of water, 18 trillion gallons of water in the lower Chesapeake. It's smack in the middle of the bay's widest point, 12 miles from the nearest mainland port. And it's incredibly low-lying. The high point on the island is 5 feet, but it rarely clears 3 feet in elevation. And because most of it is salt marsh, the great majority of the island fails to clear 1 foot above the tides.
And so what are some of its major features? I mean, you have upards, I guess, and meat soup and Canaan Canton and so on. Describe for us a little bit about those, what those were like.
Well, this is an island that for most of its history has been shaped roughly like a seahorse. And if you picture a seahorse facing to the right with a curly tail, it had a 2 mile long spit, sand spit at its southern end. The body of the seahorse is where all of the people on Tangier live. There are 460 residents, and they're crowded onto three what are called ridges. They're parallel ribs of sandy loam that rise just inches above the marsh. And then the head of the seahorse, separated from the body by a boat channel, is uninhabited marsh that islanders call upards. And at one point, it was inhabited. There were four or five different little settlements on upards. All have been abandoned, and most of at this point are underwater and well offshore.
So give me a sense about the history here. I mean, I mentioned a moment ago that John Smith ran across it, but it has this sort of interesting history in which there's a lot of activity, which certainly goes through the oyster and crab boom, as it were, and then it peters out, I guess, somewhere around the early 20th century. Give us some sense about that landscape.
Well, it was mapped first by John Smith in 1608. It was settled by a guy named Joseph Crockett in 1778. And most everybody on the island can trace his or her lineage back to that original settler. So this is an island of cousins or closer. It's one big extended family. There are about a half dozen surnames that most people on the island answer to. It has been, since the very early 19th century, almost wholly dependent on the bay for its sustenance. First fish, later oysters through most of the 19th century, and then since about 1900 on the blue crab. And it is it's the largest source of soft shell crab in the bay. So if you're eating at a restaurant in Philadelphia, Wilmington, New York, any of the big cities of the Mid-Atlantic, and you have soft shell in your plate, there's a reasonable chance that it was a Tangier crabber who caught it and delivered it to market. Since, I guess, in about the last 30 years or so, the age-old pattern of island sons following their fathers onto the water has faded, and it really can kind of trace it to the arrival of satellite TV. Which provided young islanders with insight that there were much easier and less uncertain ways to make a living than to climb aboard a little boat and go out into big water every day. And since the mid-80s, an increasing percentage of island youngsters have decided to go off to college or to the military or to offshore jobs after graduating from high school. And consequently, the average age of crabbers has steadily grown. The average age on the island has steadily grown. It's now in the mid-50s. And a very large percentage of the whole are people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Now, religion obviously plays a great role on this island. You've mentioned a moment ago Methodists. Describe a little for me how the Methodists arrived there, that particular form of Protestantism, and how has it wielded or welded together this and shaped the morals and the viewpoints of the people that you met?
Well, for much of its history, Tangier has been a working theocracy, and you mentioned the Methodist Church, and Methodism arrived on the island in 1807. It was brought there by one of the islanders, a guy named Joshua Thomas, who's credited with spreading the word of Methodism throughout much of the Chesapeake Bay region. And he was attracted to it really isn't such a surprise, I guess, if you consider that much about daily life in Tangier is beyond one's control. You know, when you make your living on the water, you operate at the whims of nature, and the Chesapeake Bay can be a scary place to make a living in a small boat, and so prayer has been kind of a rock for Tangier since Joshua Thomas brought it aboard. And you know, for throughout the 19th century, really throughout all of the 20th century, it was the defining characteristic of Tangier. Everybody, you know, there was a time when on a Sunday morning you didn't see a soul outside of Swain United Methodist Church. It's pretty much every islander was shoehorned into that building. It's lost some of its grip on the population in recent years, and a good number of Tangiermen belong to a breakaway flock of conservative Christians. Both churches are evangelical, but both still fulfill the same function that the church did when Joshua Thomas brought it aboard, which is to fortify islanders against so much of so many of the challenges they face. Now, this is hurricane bait, this little island, and it's been hammered many times by storms in the past, and it's always managed to eke its way through. Islanders will tell you that that's because they're an anointed people, that anointed by the power of prayer, and they believe that it will get them through the existential crisis they face now.
By the way, you also, of course, interviewed and talked a lot with the mayor, who obviously became a bit of national note when President Trump actually called him up. Describe a little bit about what he was like and how he fits into this menu that you paint about this very tightly knit island.
Well, James Uecker Eskridge is the mayor. He's 60 years old. He's tall, lean, kind of a ruggedly handsome guy with a Magnum PI mustache and ice blue eyes and a strong Tangier accent. And the accent on Tangier is worth noting because this is a group of people who have been isolated for so long that they have developed their own style of speech. It's a dialect really unlike any other in the country. It's a mixture of kind of the Tidewater hoi-toid accent and kind of a Cornish lilt, almost sounds Irish at times. And Tangiermen tend to stretch single-syllable words into multiple syllables, and layered on top of all that is their habit of often saying exactly the opposite of what they mean. So if you were to overhear a couple of islanders talking to each other, you'd be hard-pressed to pick out a word, and if you could pick out the words, you still might not understand what was being said. Uecker has one of these accents, but is also has a very limber vocabulary. He's a very well-spoken guy. High school education, which for a guy of 60 is unusual on Tangier. People of the boys of Uecker's generation dropped out of high school at 14 or 15 and went to work on the water with their dads, and eventually got their own boats. And like many Tangiermen, he is a staunch conservative. He's part of the 88% of the island who voted for Donald Trump in 2016. He's a pretty militant follower of the president. And in 2017, he gained the notoriety you mentioned when CNN came to the island to do a story that was kind of built around the notion that here was an island imperiled by rising seas. That had voted overwhelmingly for a president who considered climate change a hoax. So that central paradox was kind of the hub on which their story turned. And one of the scenes in this story, as aired, took place at a daily coffee clatch of old-timers that Uecker was attending. And during an interview with CNN's Jennifer Gray, a meteorologist with the network, Uecker declared that he loved Trump, quote, as much as any family member I got, end quote. Well, that created a sensation as soon as it aired. And 3 days later, the president called Uecker and reassured him that he had nothing to worry about. And Uecker quoted him as saying that Tanger Island had been there for hundreds of years and would be there for hundreds more. A lot of islanders were reassured by that. The world off the island wasn't quite as reassured. It became quite a story.
Let me ask you: why is it that, as I understand it from the book, Uecker and others really look at erosion as being the principal problem, as opposed to sea level rise, and oftentimes, as you mentioned a moment ago, don't believe that the sea is actually rising in terms of its levels. Why are those such contradictory notions in their own mind? Why do they reject one as opposed to the other? I mean, why couldn't one just accept both?
Well, it's frustrating because it really is a semantic hair splitting when you get down to it, because sea level rise and erosion are not mutually exclusive. They're interlinked. The higher the waters rise, the worse the effects of the erosion. And there's no question that Tanger does suffer from wind drip and wave erosion. It's been going on for 150 years. But the idea that the rising seas have nothing to do with it is, I think misplaced. Well, I know it is. The thing about Tanger that you need to understand is that there's a suspicion of science on the part of many in the population, and that's born in part because for years they've differed with scientists on matters related to crabbing, on the health of the bay, on the health of the crab population in the bay, on the effects of fishing or overfishing on that crab population. At any number of junctures, Tangermen have found themselves opposing the scientific view, which has run counter to their more anecdotal learning, their anecdotal knowledge of what they're actually seeing when they pull up their pots. And so that's the backdrop for this discussion about sea level rise versus erosion. Tangermen can see erosion. They can't really see the seas coming up. And part of that is that Tanger has soft edges. This is a marsh island. There's no shoreline, really, in which it's easy to measure a rising sea. And even if there were, this is a sea this is incremental change that kind of defies eyeballing. It's not something you can actually gauge if you're observing it every day. It sneaks up on you, and it particularly sneaks up on you on a marsh island with soft edges, because its effects are not what you'd expect. When seas rise around a marsh island, what they do is they drown marsh. The marsh cannot live underwater. It has to exist right at the tide line, really. And so what you've seen over the last half century, certainly, is a great deal of marsh, both around the island's edges and within its interior, too, slowly succumb to rising seas by drowning and becoming patches of open water. You've seen upland, high and dry land, become marsh. So you've seen the slow transformation of the nature of Tanger's actual stuff take place, and it's not easy to gauge watching it every day. I think that if you were to take Tangermen up in an airplane or a helicopter and have them just hover over pieces of the island, they'd be astounded, because upwards, that uninhabited marsh to the north of the inhabited part of the island, was, when I first visited, when I visited there in 2000, was a pretty solid expanse of wetland. Now it's just a loose macrame of land. It's just strings of marsh. Most of it has turned to water. And that's not something you can really see when you're down standing on the deck of a boat. It's not something you can see standing on land. You have to be elevated. You have to look down on it. And there the changes are just astounding and quite alarming.
I want to turn to the women on the island, because you sort of indicate that there's a sense that the women are really running the show, as it were, in many ways. That is, that carrying out all the tasks as the men go out to sea. Describe their role in that society.
Well, their role is to hold the whole thing together. I mean, maybe that's their role every place. But in Tangier, you see it because the men are gone all day. You know, they're either off on their boats crabbing, or they're off for 2 weeks at a stretch on tugboats. Whatever they're up to, they're not present to actually run things. And consequently, women run not only all of the island's institutions, ranging from the school to the post office to the museum to really even the churches. They also manage the island's primitive but incredibly effective communications network, and they really are the source for island opinion. They shape it far ahead of the men, and I think that it's in many ways a patriarchal society. This is a place with pretty old school values in terms of the man, you know, as the head of the family and such. But that's not to say that he actually decides anything. It's the women who run the show.
So, as you indicated a moment ago, that the island seems to be changing, not just simply in terms of, obviously, the environmental issue, but also that at one point you could go, as you indicated, and geez, you could see them all in church. And then you came back and you found that there were these signs that perhaps the world had intruded, that things were not as they once were.
Yeah, that's true. And when I put together the package for the newspaper in 2000, the way I couched it was that there were multiple forms of erosion taking hold in Tangier, not only the physical chipping away at its perimeter, but culturally the church was losing its grip. And really, perhaps most significantly, demographically, because Tangier is suffering a pretty severe population loss, severe and steady. When I was there in 2000, the population stood at 604, and there were 100 students enrolled at the Tangier Combined School, which is the only K-12 school left in Virginia. When I got back there in 2016 to spend 14 months living on the island for this book, the island's population had dropped from 604 to about 470, or a 20% drop in 16 years. And the school population had dropped from 100 students to 67 at that point. Next year, it's going to be down to 53. So it's, you reach a point, especially in an island community, where you no longer have the human critical mass to support some essential town services. And whereas on the mainland, if you live in a small town and the grocery store closes, it's pretty inconvenient. But you get in your car and you drive 5 or 10 miles to the next town and you go to the grocery store there. Not easy to do on Tangier. If the grocery store were to close on Tangier, it would invite hardship, a significant hardship, onto a population that is largely elderly, unable to go to the mainland to go shopping once a week or, frequently. And so you have that looms as a bit of a tipping point. And so the demographic erosion that you see taking place is almost in a race with the physical destruction of the island in terms of which will spell its end first.
You have, by the way, just sort of towards the end of the book, you talk about this, you just have the scene of these boats, I think it's during oystering, where they are literally one on top of the other. Describe a little bit about that and how you were able to find the descriptions that you have there of these people. I mean, literally, they're on top of one another, which is not something I would have thought of since, the waters are big, but nonetheless, they seem to be competing almost head-to-head.
Yeah, well, it surprised me too, Don. The seasons work like this. A Tangier waterman, and he's called a waterman because he goes after more than one kind of seafood. A Tangier waterman works the water for crabs from March until late October, and then oysters from December to the end of February. And it's a very solitary pursuit when you're crabbing. You have crab pots out. Nobody else can touch your pots, so you're often miles away from the next boat. Oystering, however, although the water is big, the oyster rocks on which wild oysters cluster, those are small. And so you often have dozens of boats crowded over these rocks, all dredging, pulling big steel dredges, a couple feet wide, trailed by a rope bag, much like a lawnmower bag. You have these boats jockeying for position over these rocks, and you get a couple dozen, three dozen boats doing that all at once, and it begins to look like a dogfight during the Battle of Britain. I mean, they are circling each other very tightly. We're talking coming within, you know, 3-4 feet of each other routinely. And meanwhile, it's the dead of winter. The wind's blowing. It's cold as all get out. The spray is coming off the water and freezing on every surface on the boat and the surface of the water, generally already wind roiled, is kicked up into a froth by all of this boat activity. So, you've got the boat, the deck is heaving and yawing and rolling under your boots while you're cutting these arcing licks, as they're called, with your dredge, and trying to avoid running into all of your neighbors who are around you in every direction. It's really exciting and kind of terrifying. And it was something I had no reason to expect, and it was amazed to experience.
Evan, you sort of wrap up the book with, obviously there's a loss of one of the watermen, and you describe how the community comes together at a moment's notice once the word spreads that somebody has been lost out. Describe that reaction for me, because it seems like everybody got into it almost all at once.
Yeah, they sure did. This was in April 2017. A very well-respected, experienced crabber named Ed Charnock, who was 70 years old, went out with his son Jason, who was 40, and they're both the Henrietta Sea. And they ran into trouble in some worsening weather many miles to the west of Tangier. One of the challenges of crabbing or working the water at all from Tangier is that you've got a lot of open water miles in any direction, and that creates a lot of what mariners call fetch, which is basically just room to build waves. And in this particular day, the wind was coming along at a really good clip. When they got into trouble, it was blowing at 35 miles per hour, and the seas were running 5 to 6 feet high. And the Henrietta Sea started taking on water and eventually went down, and Ed and Jason were pitched into the water, and they had time to get one SOS radio call out. And it was heard by a Tangierman, relayed to the island, and within minutes, every available boat on the island was headed west into that storm, into the teeth of a storm that all 50 men on those boats knew had already claimed one of the most capable captains among them. And I think that's a remarkable demonstration of just what community means on Tangier. This is not your typical small town. And not just because everybody's related in one form or another, but just because they've had to rely on each other for generations merely to survive, to get through the crabbing season, through the winter. They are literally willing to die for each other, and they demonstrated that day. 20 boats, 50 island men, virtually every available able-bodied man on the island went out, not sure where Ed and Jason were, but hell-bent on trying to save them, and went out at the absolute worst point of that storm. It was a tragic day. Ed lost his life. But I think the day has stayed with me more for that reaction than for the tragedy. It said a lot about Tangier.
We've been speaking with Earl Swift. He's author of a new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Don, it's been my pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.